Welcome back, everyone, to Dissecting Popular IT Nerds. I'm your host, Doug Kameen, and today I'm talking with Sean Kelly, Director of Cyber GRC and Data Protection with Highmark Health out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Welcome to the show, Sean.
Thanks, Douglas. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure, and excited to dive in on whatever it is we're going to be discussing today.
Yeah. So I had to catch myself for a second there, because I like Pittsburgh, and I almost said New York, because you and I live in New York. We were talking a little bit about remote work and other stuff like that. And I think that might be it's kind of an interesting thing to talk about. In a lot of IT jobs, a lot of us are able to work fully remote, largely, and especially if your organization is broadly based, geographically spread out, or just entirely in the cloud, you don't physically have to show up a lot of times, but it can be challenging, and getting back into the office sometimes is kind of nice. So like we were talking about the drive and stuff like that. So yep. Your office is in Pittsburgh. I should say your home office is in Pittsburgh, but you're coming from where? Whereabouts?
Yeah. So I'm in Buffalo, New York. That's where I'm currently stationed. And I work for Highmark Health, as you noted. It's a large national blended healthcare organization. But interestingly enough, in 2018, I worked for a healthcare company called Health Now, which was based in Buffalo. And then a couple of years later, Health Now affiliated with Highmark. So my headquarters sort of moved from Buffalo to Pittsburgh at that time. So that's our headquarters, and I traveled down there about once a month to get out of the house. But other than that, I am full remote and kind of adjusting to that lifestyle. But we had this little thing called the pandemic a few years back. Everyone might recall.
I don't remember.
Yeah, if you don't remember, and maybe we're so traumatized we don't, but. I think for Highmark, it really, changed their hiring strategy to be remote, kind of the point you were making, and look outside, the state borders to hire talent, and opened up a whole new pool of opportunities, and probably some challenges as well, for all involved.
Yeah. The strategies, and I'm in the same boat. I mean, so for the listeners of the podcast, Sean and I are somewhat close to each other geographically. My home office is in Rochester, New York, which is only about an hour and a half away from Buffalo, New York. I live a couple hours outside of Rochester. He lives several hours outside of Pittsburgh, which is where your home office is. But I think one of the things I'd like to explore here is the challenges of leading and being in leadership and as a remote leader, because it's a different skill set, or at least it's a modified skill set from what you might do wandering around the office. And I think that's what do you find that's most important? And maybe it's changed from when you were leading before, when you were walking around an office and being like, hey, hey, Bob, hey, Jane, what's going on today?
Yeah, I think, there are definitely differences. I am a person who I do thrive on face-to-face interaction. But it's surprisingly to me, a lot of the same principles of leadership and relationship building apply. Yes, there may be some different tools. I think we all get a little burned out on the constant Zoom or Teams calls, whatever your conferencing technology is. But to me, it's just about maintaining those connections. I do like to see people on camera, just because for me, body language is a huge part of communication. It's not about, hey, are you, paying full attention to me or whatnot. I know my current team prefers not to be on camera. So I have conceded to that fact. And, just for me, it's more important that people are, engaged. But the fundamentals of leadership to me are, if you come into work every day and with the mindset of I'm here to support the success of the people that are on my team, the rest to me kind of follows and flows down through that. Unfortunately, I don't find that to be a predominant characteristic in all leaders, at least, mm-hmm. In the spaces that I've seen. To me, it's having that one-to-one. When I became a new leader, it was at HSBC Bank, and this was back in around 2010. And we were struggling with our culture. We already had a remote work flexibility though at HSBC, which was really nice. And I think it was at the sort of at the forefront, you know, it was before people were forced to do it because of the pandemic or whatever else. So that was one of the things I enjoyed. I was raising my son at that time and had a lot of flexibility to be with, you know, at his events. And that was, you know, awesome. So I really appreciated that. But when I became a leader, we were struggling with culture because, you know, one of the biggest pieces of feedback we got is team members and individual contributors were not getting regular time with their leader. That was the number one thing that came out of the survey. And this is right around the time, as I said, I was becoming a new leader. So that's always like stuck with me because of because of the timing. But so I've always made it a point to have regular one-to-ones, you know, with my direct reports. Now being a director, fairly new, I'm 2 years into being a director rather than a team manager. One of the tougher transitions there has been not being as connected with the individual contributors on the team and getting all the, you know, feedback is filtered through, you know, through our team managers. So I've started setting up one-to-ones with all the individual contributors, though I don't have as much time to do it. You know, I set up 2 a year, but that's a new learning for me. That's been awesome to reconnect with the individual contributors, get some direct feedback from them, has really helped me feel more connected to the pulse of the team. So, you know, I'm figuring out how to manage my time in an effective way. But you know, to your original question, you know, I think one of the fears that people often face when maybe they're new to remote management situations is, how am I going to, you know, ensure that people are working, they're not goofing off? And I think it's really about trusting people. You've hired people to do the job, and as an effective leader, you should have a way to measure the outputs of those people without having to visually see them every second of the day. And I think that's tough for people to get their heads around. But the folks you might worry about in the office are going to be the folks you might worry about working remotely, and the same principles apply.
So the way I think about this, I when I try to synthesize it down, if somebody asks me, the term that I've come up with is that you have to work with intentionality, a different intentionality when you have remote staff than in person, because some of the serendipitous things that would have happened in person don't in online. You know, there's no crossing paths with people in the hallway and being like, oh, hey, that thing, you know, you just jog my memory, that thing we talk about or we need to talk about. You got 10 minutes in like a little while here or something like that. And that's so, you know, I think some of the things you brought up, I think, are things that I would put right into that bucket, the one-on-one meetings that are intentional. So like on my team, I work remotely, but we do have a corporate office where, you know, I'm in an IT, I supervise an IT operations team. And as a consequence, like they have to have a physical presence component. So we have a home base no matter what. And then there's a rotation of them being in person. I don't have to be as the executive leader, but the team still gets an opportunity to see each other with regularity. At the same time, because we're remote most days and most people are remote on those days, we've set up things like I have a huddle every morning with the team, you know, just not because they need to meet with me exclusively, but just so that everybody has the same sort of demarcation point to start the morning. Now, my team is of a size that's still possible to do. You know, you can get, you know, if you've got 35 people working for you, it's kind of hard to yank them into a morning huddle. But, yep. You know, there's different approaches. And I think about that, like, level of intentionality that's necessary to successfully make that transition from the in-persons to the virtual. And you brought up about trust and making sure that when people are, if you have a team, you gotta, at some point, you just got to be like, let them, I guess I call it managing by exception. You have to let them screw up first, and then you get the chance to rein them in. That's usually a much more effective strategy, and it saves a lot of your energy and time rather than just assuming that everybody's going to, like, you know, goof off and not, you know, not be on calls and stuff like that.
Right, right. I know. And it really is a mindset, though. You know, it's there's a coaching moments, and you hit on a, and I'm not picking on you, Douglas, at all, but you hit on kind of, you know, it's, you know, are my team going to be engaged, you know, and figuring out how to lead is really understanding each person's individual viewpoints. And I think that's why it goes back to the communication. And, you know, I think we all fall in the trap of thinking people think like we do. And if you take those, you know, if you take a Briggs-Meyer or any of those tests that tell you kind of what type of things motivate you, what personality, what color you are, mm-hmm. You know,
are you an elephant or a donkey?
I'm a sunshine yellow. I like personal interaction, but some people are reds and they like, you know, be brief, and be seated and, or yeah. be gone. Right. So it reminds you that not everybody processes things the same way. And, while that's a challenge from a leadership perspective, it's also what makes it interesting, you know, is to understand that, you know, people do tick differently, different things motivate different people. But at the end of the day, it's all about respect, and trust is built through respect, I think. And so if you, you know, and that starts with communication. So it kind of goes in that order. But, you know, if you take the time and truly listen, right? Not, you know, there's a saying about, you know, many people listen with the intent to respond and not mm-hmm. the intent to understand. And, you know, I'm not perfect, you know, by any stretch. Me too. And I at least, you know, it's something to be aware of. Right. And I think it's important as a leader to also show your vulnerability, that you're not perfect. You don't know everything. To admit when you're wrong, or to say, be able to say you're sorry, all the foundational things of any relationship really apply. I think it is incumbent on us to work, demonstrate and lead from the front that we're working hard. We're willing to jump in if as needed to support the team. If they're in a tough spot, I think those things go a long way too, that they see you're not just there handing, you know, barking out orders and then waiting to drop the hammer when something goes wrong. Which I just have one more point to tack on there, because it's mm-hmm. kind of where we started is, you know, we talk about failing fast. I hear this phrase now coming more quickly. Don't be afraid to start. Don't be afraid to fail fast. Learn from your mistakes, all these things, which we know are correct. If you look at, you know, any inventor, you know, they fail thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of times before they hit on whatever, you know, invention they had. But my question would be, or my challenge to that thinking is, how many organizations truly give the space for people to fail? Because if it goes into their performance review, the minute they make a mistake, then is that really encouraging people to fail fast? So I think we have to start thinking about the things we want people to live by and really back them up better with our, and more intentionally with our actions and behaviors.
Attention, all of my IT leaders who don't know a lot about telecom. Many of you are still managing a pile of junk and you've inherited a telecom silo. I call it a telecom time bomb. Many of us are ignoring it because the enormity of tasks surrounding a phone system replacement is overwhelming, and there's a constant barrage of direct sales reps trying to get you into a new UCaaS system today. And the whole process ends up being filled with an unforeseen comedy of errors. However, for those of you tackling such a task, you must answer, number one, are you going to go Microsoft Teams, or are you going to do something else? If it is Teams, then there's only three ways to do it, and the worst way is by just clicking the button and paying that expensive voice-enabling Teams button in your CSP's portal, or asking them to do it for you. Okay, so you're not 100% sold on Teams yet because your company has a unique group of end users. Good for you for caring. Then you may be wondering, and you need to answer all of these questions. Which platforms and interfaces have easy to self-manage portals, GUIs, so that you can make moves, ads, and changes on the fly? Which platforms are the most upgradable and have functioning APIs? Who will truly interoperate with your systems? Who's going to give you free equipment and headsets, of course, and be the most cost-effective? Who's going to support your team the best with fast technical support in minutes, not days? And who's going to meet your compliance requirements now and in the future with flexible user licensing? How about network preparation, ensuring quality of service and properly layering voice applications? How do you confidently ensure a smooth cutover and avoid going in with your fingers crossed? How do you negotiate all the legal ramifications, FCC regulated SLAs that affect your terms and conditions? Things like elasticity clauses and out of contracts if they fail to deliver. How do you know what your end users are thinking and how to deal with explaining technical to people 1,000 times that don't know how to do a transfer? And even if you have all this down, what do you do if you have limited time to research, evaluate, and confidently plan a network communications upgrade that will surely impress your key stakeholders with return on investment, CapEx, OpEx, all of this stuff evaluated? evaluating where do you get started in an ocean of vendors, which provider mix is going to best fit your company's culture versus just asking your peers who they use or shopping VoIP.com or Googling who's the best, and then you've got all kinds of people showing up in your inbox. This is why this is the classic put-off project where no one wants to take on the planning from start to finish, everything from auditing bills to surveying staff, researching providers, sifting through information, meeting with vendors, requesting proposals, ensuring all the effective transition without outages, and managing all of the negative Nancy naysayers who are surely going to complain about the new phone system. Let me and my special team of telecom nerds give you all of the rollout maps, RFP grids, and hold you by the hand for free, and even pit providers against them and give you all of the data information on what the lowest pricing has ever been with benchmark level pricing. Everything from seeing how far you can throw those old phone systems to every detail you need surrounding Microsoft Teams integrations or all of the best UCaaS providers with custom and in and out of the box APIs. Also, some of you are dealing with who's the best fit contact center software providers for your unique group of end users and agents and staff. How can you leverage AI software to drastically increase agent efficiency? And let's not forget about workforce management tools to ensure proper staffing, all while avoiding annoying meetings and sales reps telling you it's the end of the month, President's Day specials. All you need to do is email telecom@popularit.net and we will give you all of the information, everything you need, and hold you by the hand for free. And if you like the information, great, do whatever you want with it. And if not, you can tell us to go pound sand.
So that's got me thinking about the, I would call it the other extreme of that. And I love your point and I wholeheartedly support it. So this is not meant to be a counterpoint to it. When you were describing it to me, I was thinking about the people who move fast and then use that as an excuse to not operate ethically, isn't the right word, but just like they don't do it right, if you will. They run ramshackle over people. They're not considerate. They're not these other things. They're like, oh, but I'm just like, it's all because I move super fast. That's the problem here. And it's like, no, that's not necessarily the problem here. The problem here is you're not considerate. You could fail at this and still be nice.
Yes. I love that point. And actually, as I told you, I'm a big audio book person. I like to listen into my commutes, but I'm brushing up on the 7 Habits again. I did read the book a long time ago, Stephen Covey's book. Mm-hmm. But it does talk about, you know, it's not a win if you get to the end of a project and you leave a wake of dead bodies and, you know, behind you, and you burned all the bridges and credit that you have with everybody. To me, it's incredibly important to build and preserve relationships with the stakeholders in your organization that you rely on. I see those bridges being burned on a daily basis for pressures, you know, coming down from executive leadership. This needs to get done. You know, we have to find a way to, and I think that's, you know, as a director, that's my, one of the big roles I serve is being that buffer for the team where they're not pressured into running roughshod over their colleagues and their peers while they're trying to get things done, and to preserve that collaborative approach to getting things done and build those relationships. Because when you need the favor later down the road, you're going to get it if you have a strong relationship, or you're more likely to get it than, again, you get one thing done, but now everything behind it suffers. So you really have to play the long game. It's just who has the, who's really committed to preserving that. That's, you know, to me, that's what organizational health looks like. So you're building those daily credits with people, not burning bridges.
Yeah. So in my organization, we a number of us, the executives team, and in our high level leadership folks, like our operations leadership folks, so a couple of years ago, we went through Brené Brown's Dare to Lead and training for that. And I think the analogy that Brené Brown uses in her book is like a marble jar. So each time you do something good or there's positive outcome, you kind of add a marble to the jar, and you can lose the whole jar really fast though. Like you break the jar and they shatter everywhere and they're all gone. You know, and so you have to be mindful about how, you know, you build them all up, but you can lose them all very rapidly.
I love that. I mean, I love the vision, having something tangible there that can remind you to do the right things. I'm not familiar with the book, but maybe I'll check it out. But I love the idea of kind of reinforcing or reminding yourself, because not all these things are top of mind. You know, I find myself pulling myself out of a certain mindset and kind of, hey, you know, I got to stick to what I'm, you know, be about it, you know, don't just talk about it is really important. So I like that idea of not, you know, kind of visualizing what you're trying to do. I haven't gotten to that point, but I'm always looking at ways I can better organize my tasks at work, prioritize things, and, you know, make things a little bit more efficient, because at the end of the day, that I do think that leads to people being more happy and satisfied with their job if they understand priority of things. And, you know, I'm a firm believer we could get our work done 30 hours a week instead of 40 if we could only get out of our own way.
There's been some studies on this recently. Yeah. I don't know if you've seen some of the they've popped up in the news, but there's been some academic studies where they, I don't know if they paid these folks or however they did it, but they put these companies onto 4-day work weeks and found that the staff liked it so much that they were just more productive, even though they, you know, they worked less time, not for 10-hour days, but just a 4-day work week.
It's funny how when people are happy, they produce better work. You know, it's not just
shocking.
Grind. It is a shocking revelation. But and it isn't. Like, anybody listening will be like, that's super obvious. But think of how many organizations actually operate that way. I have yet to see an organization that truly stands behind that in word and in action. So I do think there's a lot of room for cultural improvement, at least in every organization, you know, I've been at, and from those that, you know, I've spoken to with colleagues and friends. And yeah, we're the rare company will get it right. Hmm. I'll just point a couple of them out, because these are companies that I think about often. We have a grocery store in our area called Wegmans. I don't know if they're down your way at all.
Oh yes, Wegmans is down.
Okay. Here. Okay.
Yes,
okay.
Yes. Wegmans is like, well, for those listeners who are not on the East Coast of the United States, Wegmans is a particular joy to have in your community at any time. It's like, it's a grocery store that is its own destination.
Yeah, exactly. And my wife told me, under no uncertain terms would I move her anywhere that didn't have a Wegmans grocery store. So it's, you know, as you said, most people feel the way that you do, Douglas, and I feel the same way when I'm in there. But why is it, right? Why does it feel that way when you walk in there? It's, you know, they've built a culture there where they do take care of their employees. The employees aren't miserable. They are willing to help you, like truly willing to help you. So it's just a nice feel. They keep their store clean. They've trained the part I really love is I believe they train all of their associates on the cash registers. So when the queues get longer, people can come to the front and help. So I'm like, this is awesome. I mean, these are like, if you take these ideas, these simple ideas, and you pull them together and you stick to them, you get a great experience. And I'm glad they're successful, because I think they're doing it the right way. And I think a lot of organizations could learn from their example.
Mm-hmm. So your current role, your director of, and I just listed it as it's sort of, because it's a very, it's long, it's an acronym.
It's long.
So cyber GRC and data protection. So yep. I know what GRC is, but for the benefit of our listeners.
Yes, GRC. Okay. It's governance, risk, and controls. The C normally stands for compliance, but we have a compliance area in our organization. So we've repurposed the C to say controls. Yes, very, very tricky. I'm not a fan of acronyms, but we can save that for the next episode. That's my role. And data protection, I just took that team on in January, but I had actually managed that team before. So in a sense, I'm very familiar with the team, and they came back as part of a reorg, as part of my organization. So I'm excited to have them back. And the interesting part for those, I assume there are many IT and possibly cyber listeners out in the audience, is, you know, you might say, what do the two areas have to do with one another? Because I even had people on my own team asking that very question. So if you think about it, you know, from a cyber perspective, think of how different your job would be if there were no sensitive data to protect. You know, there wouldn't be as much risk. You might still have transactional systems and things of that nature, but on the whole, risk kind of follows the sensitivity of the data and us trying to protect it. So I do think they're both pervasive throughout the organization, and that's the relationship that we have. How we go about our jobs, there's definitely differences there. There's no doubt, but so it's been an interesting journey, and these are the things that I think about kind of day in, day out, is how we can get the synergy between the two teams. How can we do our jobs, you know, more effectively?
Mm-hmm. So this is not the only thing you do. I mean, this is your work job, your day job, if you will. But, yep. You know, you also do a little side gig. So why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about that? And we're going to give a nice little plug for your side gig here.
I appreciate it. I'm sure David Spark, who is the producer of the podcast that I work for called Cybersecurity Headlines, it's part of the CISO series podcast family. And I can plug it shamelessly. I'll tell you right off, I learned very early in my career, because my first job was actually a sales job and I was not good at it. So I can only sell and talk, talk up things that I truly believe in. And I believe in the podcast because I was an avid listener before I, you know, joined the team and started working on it, which happened to be during COVID. I met David through a chance encounter on one of his other podcasts, and there was a networking event after. So I met him. He was happened to be looking for a reporter for his podcast, and I was kind of in the spot. It was pandemic. I was in a bit of a gray zone, not feeling like terribly engaged. I needed to basically kick myself in the butt, and I said, "I'll try it. You know, I'm a fairly good public speaker. It's interesting to me. It will help me keep on top of, you know, the top cyber news stories, which I need to do for my job anyways. So I'm like, I'll give it a shot. I've never podcasted." and he's like, "Really? You want to try it?" And I'm sure I sent him a demo, and the audio was levels were off, but it was good enough to earn me a spot on the team. I'll tell you though, you know, I didn't start off awesome, and I didn't realize how much work goes into producing. It's the format of Cybersecurity Headlines is 6 to 8 minute news readout of the top cyber stories of the day. It's every weekday, every morning. It's been successful because it is short. I think if we, you know, stretched it out, you know, it would, you know, the thing that's nice, people can drink their coffee and by the time they're done with it, be done with catching up on the news. So that's been the trick to the one that I work on. Mm-hmm. It takes about 5 hours of production to make, you know, 8 minutes of a podcast. So I was surprised about how that goes in, how much work goes into a short format podcast. But, you know, over time, I've been at it for 3 years now. And over time, I like to think that I got more proficient at it. But it's been awesome. Yeah, it's been a lot of fun and a big learning curve.
Yeah, no, I've given it a listen myself. It's great. It's a nice little just these like quick hit tidbits. Here's the headlines. Here's the stuff. If you're thinking about, if you're in the space, particularly, and I say if you're in the space, and maybe I should even qualify it that closely, because all of us in IT, whether it's on the IT security side or the operations side, like the stuff all applies to everything we do. We all kind of need to be up on it and know about it as it's going on. So yeah, it's a great podcast to get a chance to listen to. If some of our listeners get a chance, that's the CISO series, Cybersecurity Headlines podcast.
Yeah. Thank you for the plug. The other thing though, I think that kind of comes into it is, the phrase, you have to be willing to suck at something before you get good at it, I think totally applies here, because while I did have maybe some baseline skills that helped, I really wasn't very good at it. And you have to be, you know, humble enough to work through that. You know, I didn't just start off being smooth at it. So, I just thought from demonstrating that for myself was useful. And I would encourage those that are young, you know, earlier on in their own careers or whatever they're working on, just have the grit to kind of stick with things, because, you know, you can get good at them, even if maybe it's not going particularly well for you at the moment. You know, just learn and try to, you know, stick with it and improve. So,
yeah. And I'm glad you brought that up, because putting yourself in a slightly uncomfortable position is a great way to grow. I mean, there was a couple of years ago for me, it's been going on 2 years now. So I'm on an advisory council for this organization, the American Registry for Internet Numbers, ARIN. So for those out there who are unfamiliar, ARIN is where you get your IP addresses from if you need an internet accessible IP address. They are the organization, the caretaker of those. And when I first showed up, like, I knew what ARIN did, but here I was in Los Angeles. You know, I flew all the way across the country to their policy meeting. And when I get there, they're like, oh, your time to give your speech for when you know, why they should elect you, that'll be tomorrow at 2:00. And I'm like, wait, what?
Surprise.
You know, like, I filled out an application. I was, you know, I was expected to get some sort of, like, you know, hey, we'll tune in for an interview, or we'll, you know, we'll pick for the pool or something. Like, nope. On live streamed on the internet with 175 people in the room. And I had to get on the on stage at the dais and speak, you know, and like, that's that. First of all, you know, that's, of course, is hard, but to the point you were making exactly, like, different paths. Like, if you're moving up through leadership, there are times where you have to push yourself out of your comfort zone to make it to that next step and get that opportunity to do something different.
100%. And it's counterintuitive, right? Like, none of us really like feeling uncomfortable. You wouldn't have preferred someone to drop that little surprise on you about your acceptance speech or, it is important. And just, you know, being here with you, you know, I was nervous coming on. This is really the first time I've been interviewed on a podcast of this format. You know, I've worked on my own podcast, as you mentioned, but, you know, and how did I get here? Right. We met because I presented at the New York State Cyber Conference that you happened to be sitting in on the session, and you decided to come up and introduce yourself to me. And I got there because I happened to meet one of the people that I was co-presenting with and decided that, hey, I'll volunteer to work on, you know, Mike Mallory, be a moderator for one of the sessions that he runs in his cyber club. So it does all chain together. And I think that's why, you know, people want to advance to whatever their goal is in their career. They want to advance with one big step, I feel like, or fall into that trap. Whereas to me, it's really about doing one small thing and doing it well at a time. You know, I liken it to did you ever watch anybody pour the foundation for a house?
I have. My brother actually works in that business, not pouring the foundations. He's a plumber. And so he lives in Texas, and where they don't have basements in their houses. So they put slab foundations. So I've both witnessed and talked to extensively about how this goes down.
Well, that was a surprise to me, but I would bet, and I haven't, and I bet most people haven't, because it would be probably boring for most people who, you know, either don't work in the field or know somebody who's working in that field. But, you know, I don't want to live in a house that doesn't have a solid foundation. So it's extremely important, you know, for these, you to do one thing at a time, do it right. Like I always envision, you know, just forming a brick, making it perfectly level and just setting it down, you know, and if you can do that every day that you come in, by, you know, 3 months, 6 months down the road, you're going to be like, wow, I have this foundation that I've built because I took the time to do things the right way. You know, one small step at a time. So that's how I think about success. I think that is the key to success. It's not big bang or coming up with some, let's, you know, drop the shiny tool into our, you know, AI is, you know, and before that it was zero trust networks, and there's always going to be the next big thing. But you can only move fast if you have taken time to put that foundation in place first. So people want to rush to AI. I think the ones that will be successful are the ones that already have organizational competency. They're making decisions in the right way. They're leading their people in the right way. If you are doing those things already, I think it will be much easier for you to pivot to whatever the next thing is that you want to implement versus, you know, doing the wrong things over and over. And we've seen that, or, you know, throughout the course of our career, at least I have.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned that too, because I think about, so of course, AI in my space is not that it's not all over the map for all of us, but in the IT space, you know, I, as an IT executive leader, I face constant questions. Hey, what's our strat? What are our tools? What do we want? Can we use this? I want to do that thing. And I think about, I think this will dovetail exactly with what you said. To me, being a very fast follower. So if you're at the bleeding edge, there will be some people who have success at the bleeding edge. They will stumble their way into like amazing opportunity, and then they'll hit it big, if you will. And, but I think that most people don't recognize that the ability to succeed in that type of environment is small. So like 100 people try, and like one or less than one really hits it out of the park with that. The real success is the people that follow that group oftentimes, you know, the ones who are a little bit more methodical, that are willing to be like, okay, let's just like, let's let the hype die down for a second here. And then let's use our knowledge to like apply this effectively and not just rush headlong into something because it seems like it's, you know, the new big thing.
Yep. It's like a moth to the light scenario. And I agree 100%. And so it all goes back to, again, that organizational competency that I was talking about. What I mean is, many organizations are not very good at project management. I saw a statistic like only 10% of large projects, succeed. I think they defined it as $10 million or more invested. And the number one reason for that is not having clear objectives of what the project was trying to accomplish in the first place. So the same applies here. AI, we want to do that. Why? What is the value that you're going to get? What is the use case that you think will help your organization? You know, and obviously in my line of work, working in healthcare, we have regulated data we're trying to protect. My job is to squarely protect that regulated data with the data protection team. So we have to be mindful of what are the limitations, what's the risk. It doesn't mean we can't do anything. It just means we have to appropriately control it, make sure the right things are in place and the guardrails for using it. Of course, we want the business to be more efficient operationally and to save money and to be able to do things faster with less administrative and cost overhead. So, but again, if you are prepared and you know your business well, and again, going back to that those foundational things, I think you'll be able to do these things in a more agile manner and figure out what are the target objectives here that we want to do with AI, or what things do we think are feasible, and who should be involved in making those decisions about how we want to apply it.
So when I go into more, let's have some like fun talk for a minute here.
This wasn't fun. I've been having fun the whole time.
It's true. That's true. It is true. It's fun. I guess fun wasn't the right word to use. Yeah. I'll use the word, let's talk more like personal fun stuff. So you mentioned about you got into your podcast work during the pandemic when you were like, I needed something to be engaged with. So during the pandemic, when I needed something to be engaged with, I decided that we were going to go camping, and I bought a vintage Airstream, ripped it down to the metal, and built it up. So I took like a year rebuilding it. But what thing? So that's my segue.
Wait. Did you actually camp in it, or was?
We use it all the time.
There's a blog out. Was the goal to strip it down and rebuild it? That sounds its own.
It was. It took a year. I did all the carpentry. So the cabinets, I built all of them. Not just the cabinets, the countertops, the drawers, the walls. I sewed the upholstery. I sewed the curtains.
Are you kidding me? That is awesome.
Yeah. So it was a fun project. I don't want to do it again, but we do use it. And I did chronicle it on a blog. So I have a blog out on the internet here that, you can go see the adventures of my Airstream. But the segue.
I will definitely check it out, and I'll let you get to your segue. Sorry, I keep interrupting you.
That's fine. The segue is, what interesting thing have you done or do that people wouldn't know about?
Well, you're going to lead with that and then try to follow it up. That was pretty awesome. I have hobbies. I love music. I say musician in the loosest sense of the word, but I love playing music from a young age. I've always had a good ear for it and just been interested. I actually took up the piano I took some lessons earlier on in my life, but didn't really stick with it. And I said it over the pandemic, that was the thing I was going to do. So I ordered an electric piano, and I have worked at it for probably 4 years now. And actually tomorrow I'm playing my first piano gig. So I'm down at a brewery here downtown Buffalo, and have a small group of friends and family that are going to come out and watch. But speaking of getting yourself out of your comfort zone, I'm very nervous for it. You know, you can't practice enough, but I'm excited for it. And my wife's like, it seems a little attention seeking.
and it is, right?
Like, how do you say, like, for any actor or any musician, any entertainer or whatever, and I don't consider myself an entertainer, again, using words loosely, but, you know, for me, what I like about it is it does bring people together. It kind of pushes me to learn and try to be as good at it as possible. So I enjoy that challenge and kind of hits a lot of the check marks for me that are really gratifying. So I'm excited and nervous for it, but that's what I do in my free time. But I do also love to camp, and I lived in Portland, Oregon for almost 3.5 years. And I know Portland's become sort of a political hot lightning rod in the past few years, but it is an awesome place, and it has infinite outdoors activities to do. And I just fell in love with hiking and kayaking, and I was an hour from the coast and an hour from Mount Hood, and could make it to Vancouver, BC in 4 hours. It just is the Pacific Northwest is a magical place. So I really enjoy being in the woods. I'm not a highly religious person, but the woods is definitely where I feel, you know, most spiritual and kind of centered. So I try to get out there away from unplugged, you know, as often as I can to kind of recharge the batteries.
Mm-hmm. So this piano gig, what kind of music are you playing at the piano gig?
All right. Well, my figure is I'm not a great singer, though I will sing. Mm-hmm. So I'm working on that. But I try to do sing-alongs so that maybe people, in the hopes that maybe people will sing along with me and drown me out a little bit. But it's the hits. It's Billy Joel. It's Elton John.
Billy Joel was the first thing I was going to mention. Yes, but I was like, do I actually go there?
I do have Piano Man down. I think you can't play a gig without it, but it took me the longest amount of time. The actual, the main part of it is not that difficult to play, mm-hmm. but it's the little embellishments. And then it's the solo is very difficult. And then learning how to play the harmonica part over the top of that, you know, so putting it all together is very difficult.
So you're doing the harmonica too.
Yeah, got the harmonica.
So this is growing rapidly here. You're like, oh, I learned to play the piano. But what you're really saying is you learned to play Billy Joel's Piano Man the actual way. The piano, the harmonica, you know the words. Like, that's a feat. That's a feat right there.
It is. Well, we'll see how it goes tomorrow, because this will be the first time out in front of a group of people playing it. But I feel like I can make it through. I'm not going to say there's going to be zero flaw-free, but you know what's worth doing that is. So it'll be. I'm excited for it. Hopefully, you know, people enjoy it too.
Yeah, yeah. So now for the listeners of the podcast, we're recording is the middle of July. It'll probably be several weeks before this podcast episode comes out. So this gig will have long since passed by the time you're actually listening to this podcast.
So this is not a promo.
Yeah.
Nor have I told people where it is, but that's okay. I don't think it would have a big draw anyways. I'm hoping really, you know, I'm not playing for tips. I'm more the tip your bartender. I'm just happy to be coming into this establishment and able to sit down at this nice piano and play for a little while. So that's how I look at it. But and maybe get a free beer. That would be a good repayment for me. But I'm really excited about it. And thanks for the plug.
Isn't this just what Piano Man, like, I mean, you're going to sing Piano Man and then you're going to talk about like putting bread in your jar and all this other stuff. And people are going to want to tip you.
I know. Well, if they really want to, I'm not going to push back. I'm not going to push back too hard, but I'm not putting the jar out there. So, yeah.
So let's see. Another maybe fun question here.
Okay.
Star Wars or Star Trek?
Oh, I mean, for me, it's Star Wars all day long. Yeah, I know. I'm going to make a lot of people upset. Of course, that was your point in asking. But definitely, you know, Star Trek just didn't grab me. And I can't remember what show. I think it was, I'm catching up on Suits. So the Netflix series Suits. And I'm not an early adopter to your earlier point. I jump on these things years after they've aired. But, you know, for me, it's just the effects, and you know, it just didn't grab me as a kid. And whereas Star Wars, it just sucked me right in from day one. I had when my son was old enough, I had him watch the original trilogy. I think it's episodes 4, 5, and 6. I don't care as much for the newer ones, but my son got into it, you know, because those were coming out around the time he was at that age. So I watched some of that. I'm going to stay away from Jar Jar, but no, I appreciate Star Trek, and actually they came out with a newer version that my son made me sit down and watch.
I'm a big Star Trek fan, and before I get flame mail from the audience of our podcast, there's nothing wrong with Star Trek. It's great. I do enjoy a Star Wars, Star Wars, I should say. I do enjoy a good Star Wars movie periodically. I saw some statistic that said that the amount of like produced content for the two series. So because Star Trek was always largely a TV show, the amount of content to consume. So Star Trek has something like 700 hours worth of content over across all of the franchises series, and Star Wars is only like, I don't know, like 100 maybe.
Wow. I'm surprised by that there's that much of a disparity. So that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's just because of the nature of how it's produced. Like up until recently, Star Wars was never a TV show. I mean, now there's like all the Mandalorian and all those other shows that are out there. But Star Trek had was other than the movies as after the TV shows moved to movies, they've always had TV episodes, which is like, so you're adding like 20, 30, maybe sometimes 50 episodes a year of content to the catalog.
Yeah, and I don't mean this as a personal attack on you now that I know your position on Star Trek or anybody, any of the listeners, but I'm going to double down and saying watching 700 hours of Star Trek footage sounds excruciating to me. So I'll stop there before I start. Please don't give anybody my phone number or address.
we'll publish it on LinkedIn. It's all good.
Okay. Oh, I'm safe then.
Thank you. So let's see. We're kind of coming up on time here, but I did want to just another fun question before we wrap here. Okay. What do you have any like old tech? You mentioned you kind of get late to some of these games. Do you hang on to old tech? Is there something like in your house you'd be like, I still have this, and I'm kind of almost embarrassed to admit it.
Oh my gosh, I'm trying to think. Not really. And I was never, I'm going to disappoint you with this one, to end on, but, I do have an Atari throwback. So I don't have the original Atari anymore. And for it, was it 2600?
Is that 2600? Yeah.
2600. Yeah. That was cool. Before that we had Intellivision. We never had a Pong machine though. I've seen them and, seen pictures of them, I should say. So I don't have any like vintage tech. I'm just trying to think other than like, I do have a couple of my old flip phones around in the drawer
just for
fun. Yeah, I do have a flip phone. I think it was a Samsung. So yeah, I have that, but I wasn't the person that was pulling servers apart, when I was a kid. I always think that's the developers and the engineers, but I have nothing against it. I have great respect for that mindset. I always did have a curiosity for how things work, but so I would say the throwback Atari is probably the thing that I actually still long for and will take out and play every once in a while. So that would be probably my best answer, not a weak one by my own admission.
So at my house, so I live in a mid-century modern house that I somewhat intentionally keep a lot of mid-century components in it. So in my on my wall, I have a yellow, one of those like wall hung phones, a rotary dial phone.
Oh yes,
yeah, it still works. You can make calls with the rotary dial phone in my house.
Really? That is something. Do you have a long cord on it so that you can walk into the other room so people can't hear you for privacy?
You got it, man. Yeah. It's got like that 10-foot cord, the coily cord that could stretch way out.
Yes. So, ours was yellow. The one that I grew up with was yellow.
This one's yellow. Yellow.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe it's the only color they come in. I don't know.
There was like three or four colors, but yeah, it was like a yellow, like a kind of a brownish one. There was a pink one, the peach color, I think maybe. So.
Yeah, why do we get so boring with colors? It was pretty cool back in the day. But all the cars I feel like are black and white and gray anymore, navy. Mm-hmm. So not nothing too exciting. So yeah. I had an orange car, and my neighbors would laugh at me as I drove it through the neighborhood. I didn't mind, but I figured a change up is okay.
You weren't committing crimes, like, so it'd be like find the orange card. Like, you how
literally
many of those
could, yeah, you literally couldn't. Yeah, so that was my way to keep from committing crimes, was to get the orange card, just keep myself honest.
Mm-hmm. So just before we leave here, what advice do you have for future leaders? You've given some along the way, as we've talked for the last 40 minutes or so, but what kind of closing advice would you have for folks who are coming up in the IT space or coming up in the cybersecurity leadership space, which is where you live mostly nowadays? What advice do you have for them about becoming a leader?
I mean, the best thing that, and I do speak at some colleges. I love talking to college students because they're very eager to learn and understand, what are the keys to being successful? What takeaways? Hungry for knowledge, very highly collaborative too, which is awesome. But my answer really is always simple for leadership. If your heart is in the right place, the rest of the things can be learned. And there are quite a few things to learn within leadership. But to me, it's all about coming with the mindset that your number one purpose is to support the success of the folks on your team, to truly understand what makes them tick, remove obstacles, barriers that might be getting in the way of them succeeding, and of course to promote their growth. I think too many leaders lead in fear of people leaving them or not liking them or not getting things done. And the truth is, the reality is, and I tell my people this all the time, we're probably not going to retire together. Maybe we will. It's unlikely though. And I'm not afraid of you. You might learn everything there is to know about GRC or data protection, and it's time to move on. And I will help you find that next role or give you a reference or whatever I can do to help you in your career is healthy. And I think just putting that type of positive energy into it sounds corny, but like putting it into the universe, I think is really important to kind of have that mindset. Then we're all vulnerable. We all have fears, but you really just can't lead with those fears, because that's when sort of toxicity can, I've seen it slip into, people's habits and the culture. So I think it's just having that openness and really coming to work every day, just realizing your primary job is to support the growth of your team members, and their successes are your successes. Their failures are your failures. And just, get up, dust yourself off and keep at it.
Great. Thank you. So Sean, thank you so much for investing your time with us on the podcast today.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on, Douglas. It was a pleasure. It was very, very comfortable. And that I credit to you, but I appreciate all the questions and the dialogue. It's been an awesome hour.
That's a wrap on today's episode of Dissecting Popular IT Nerds. I'm Doug Kameen, and we look forward to coming to you on our next episode.